This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. The big news this week is that former President Donald Trump has been indicted on criminal charges by a New York grand jury. We know you're getting updates and analysis about that from NPR, the BBC, and the other programs you hear on WVXU. So today we're going to do what we do each Friday, discuss some of the most important and most interesting local, state, and regional news of the past week. We're going to start with the latest from the Ohio State House and the efforts of some House Republicans to go around the Speaker and force a vote on a measure that would make it harder to amend the state's constitution. Joining me now to discuss that effort and other news from Columbus that you reported this week is Ohio Public Radio and Television State House News Bureau reporter and producer Joe Ingles. Welcome back, Joe.
Great to be with you.
We always appreciate your time. We know how busy you are. We've talked before on the program about this division among Republicans in the Ohio House. Remind us of how that started.
Well, okay. The Speaker of the House was elected with some Republicans, mostly rural Republicans, but also a whole lot of Democrats. The guy who has been elected as the leader of the Republican caucus thought that he was going to be elected the Speaker of the House because in November there was a vote that was taken and Derek Marin, the representative that he was the one that they voted and he thought he was going to be leader of the House. So ever since then, Speaker Jason Stevens and Representative Derek Marin have kind of been at odds because Marin is the leader of the caucus Republicans. But Jason Stevens is the leader of the Ohio House with the help of Democrats. So that kind of sets up a whole twist here because we've had a lot of things where one faction would say something and then another faction would say something different. So they're constantly at odds. So remember that in the back of your head. So fast forward to now, there's a 60% majority a constitutional amendment proposal that if lawmakers pass it, then they could put on the ballot a measure that would let voters in Ohio decide whether you need a 60% majority to approve constitutional amendments. This is very important. It's a priority piece of legislation for the Republicans. There was a special committee looking at this. The Speaker, Jason Stevens, appointed one of Derek Marin's top supporters as the committee chair for that special committee that's been hearing this resolution. And there has been one hearing that has been a sponsor hearing, so only the sponsor talked, no public input anywhere. And it was very short. That's all that we've had since, and it's been like 40 days since this appointment was made. So what we saw this week were a bunch of Marin supporters file a discharge petition. And that means that they can go around all these committees, and if they get enough signatures on that discharge petition, which would be half of the representatives plus one, if they get enough, they can put that measure on the floor without it having to go finish the committee process. So right now, they're kind of halfway there, but a lot of the people who have been backing Stevens haven't signed it yet, and we don't know whether they will. In the meantime, what's happening is Jason Stevens is saying, wait a minute, I put your guy in charge of this committee over here, and he didn't get the job done. He has been holding back and not scheduling the committee meetings, and it's his fault that this isn't happening. So he pulled the leader, Scott Wiggum, who he had appointed for that committee. He pulled Scott Wiggum off, and he put his own representative, Phil Plummer, in as the head of that special committee. And that's just happened. So now we're waiting to see what happens with this committee. Are they going to take this up? And if they do, are they going to get it through the process in time? Are more people going to sign on that discharge petition? There's a whole lot of questions right now up in the air.
Well, and supporters of this amendment to that would the 60% threshold amendment, as you described it, they're in a hurry to get this done. Talk about why that is.
Well, In November, Ohioans probably can be voting on, it looks like right now, that there's going to be enough support and petition signatures to put an abortion issue on the ballot that would allow Ohioans to basically enshrine abortion rights into the Ohio Constitution. They need about 414,000 valid signatures to put that on there. They've been collecting signatures. They've got thousands of signatures already. They've got, you know, a lot of festivals, a lot of things happening, you know, in the next couple of months where they'll have opportunities to get a lot of signatures. And if they can get those signatures, and it's, I think it's July 5th, if I'm not mistaken, that they have to get the 414,000 valid signatures. If they get those by then, that issue will be on the ballot. And so the reason there's a rush on this 60% thing is that the polling shows that if you look in Ohio, polling shows that it's hard to get 60% on abortion rights because you can kind of whittle it. The other side can kind of whittle it down and confuse it or, you know, make people kind of think twice about it. So, and if you look at passage in other states, the case has been that there's the passage rate is somewhere between 50 and under 60% in most cases. So what a lot of the Republicans who oppose the abortion amendment really want to try to stop it. And this is one way to stop it, although very few of them will admit that this is the reason they want to stop it. They say, well, there's too many special interests in the Constitution, and they want to make it harder to put a constitutional amendment before voters because they think it's, you know, something that should be more sacred. But when you ask anyone what special interests mean, that's in the eye of the beholder because, you know, the Republicans have special interest groups, the Democrats have special interest groups, and, you know, this would affect anything going forward, not just abortion. It would affect, you know, any measure coming forward, and it may be a measure that the Republicans like that they can't get the support for.
And so if they can get this through the process quickly enough, in theory, there could be a special election in August that would be put this issue on the ballot and set it up so that abortion rights proponents would have to get that meet that 60% threshold if this 60% thing passes in August. Is that right?
Yeah, and that's another big thing, Lucy. I mean, this thing has so many twists and turns, it's really hard to understand it and follow it. But just in December, there was a bill that passed into law that said, hey, we're not going to have any special elections in August anymore. Those things are too expensive. They have low turnout. So the lawmakers passed this thing. It hasn't even gone into effect. That happens on April 7th that goes into effect. And before that law even goes into effect, there are bills in the House and the Senate to create a special election in August to do the abortion petition.
So much going on. So you had another story this week that is related to that reproductive rights amendment that supporters are hoping to get on the ballot this fall. Tell us what's going on with a lawsuit related to that language.
Well, two Southwest Ohio people filed a lawsuit, and they said that the Ohio ballot board, there's a whole process you have to go through to put something on the ballot, right? And one of the things that has to happen is this group of lawmakers known as the ballot board, and it's got more Republicans on it than Democrats. The ballot board has to approve the language as like one petition or two separate petitions or maybe three separate petitions. So the ballot board, they decided to approve it as one petition. So the petitions are out there now. The people who want abortion rights are circulating them. There's one petition that you sign, not two or three. But this group from Southwest, or these two people from Southwest Ohio, there's two of them, they said that, wait a minute, that petition should really be, there should be two or three petitions because they think there's more than one part in this. And they say the ballot board just got it wrong. So they're going to the Supreme Court. And they're asking the Supreme Court to rule that the ballot board got it wrong and that it has to go back to the petition and split it out. Well, if that happens, that means that all of the petitions being signed now will kind of go by the wayside, and they'll have to, the people who want abortion rights will have to start all over and basically get new petitions and then start circulating them again. So, and there is a deadline, like we said, of July 5th to get these in. So that would put them in a very difficult position to try to get enough signatures to do this. So we're kind of looking to see where this goes from here. The Ohio Supreme Court, as everyone knows, has more Republicans on it than Democrats. And the reason that matters is the Republican justices who are on it have come out in favor of anti-abortion groups during, you know, different campaigns and said things, you know, helped them out in different things as guest speakers and whatnot. So, you know, there's a thinking that there is a ideological idea behind most of the judges that they don't like abortion. Whether that will actually weigh into their opinion is another thing. But, you know, getting it before the Ohio Supreme Court, that's, you know, another way that, you know, they can try to stop this.
And you talked with several lawyers and legal experts about this. What did they tell you? What do they think the Supreme Court's likely to do?
Well, I have, you know, one lawyer who does a lot of Republican causes says, yeah, I think it's more than one petition. So I think the Supreme Court will probably say, yeah, you got to go back to the drawing board. Then I had another lawyer who kind of represents the people who are circulating the petitions, and the ballot board got it right. You know, this is the way it's going to be. And then I had someone who really is just a constitutional lawyer, and he said, yeah, this could happen, that the ballot board, you know, the Supreme Court could say, hey, ballot board, you got it wrong, and send it back, and it would be a problem. But here's the thing. The ballot board is made, the majority is Republican. And even when they were approving these petitions as one petition, approving this language, I should say, as one petition, when they were in that process, the members of the ballot board said, hey, or at least one member said she was horrified by it. And we know that they don't like the idea of legal abortion. Some of them, they've come out, you know, saying that in the past. So, you know, it's not exactly like you had an abortion friendly ballot board that made it one petition. They were unanimous in their decision, whether they were Republican or Democrat, that this was one petition. So basically, you've got the Supreme Court would have to go against that wave. And that's kind of a, you know, maybe a long shot and an uphill battle, but it is possible.
Yeah. There's one more story you reported this week that I wanted to talk to you about just real briefly for a minute or two. You reported on a bipartisan effort to abolish the death penalty in Ohio. This is something that's been introduced, you know, many times before. Do you think this effort has a chance with this legislature?
Well, you know, there's always a chance, I guess, but not a really good chance, because I'll tell you, it's started out that, you know, a decade ago, it was mostly Democrats who supported it. And then it's come along, and over the years, some Republicans have gotten behind it. But the leadership of the Senate says he's not behind it. He says he won't stop it if they get enough votes. He'll let it go forward, but he's not behind it. And we know that in the House, there are a lot of representatives who still want the death penalty on the books, and prosecutors will tell you that having the death penalty on the books is an advantage to get a very harsh sentence. So, but if this were to pass, what this would do would basically say there wouldn't be a death sentence, but that you could get life without parole.
Well, I know you'll be following that.
We'll be.
I've been talking with Ohio Public Radio and Television State House News Bureau reporter and producer Joe Ingles. Thanks so much for your time today, Joe.
Thank you, Lucy.
Now we're going to follow up on an issue we've discussed several times on Cincinnati Edition, the City of Cincinnati's residential tax abatement program. Cincinnati City Council voted to overhaul the program after several weeks of debate. Joining me now to explain what all this means for homeowners and discuss some of her other reporting from the past week is WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Welcome back, Becca.
Thanks, Lucy. I know I don't sound like myself, but I promise it's me.
Yes, it is Becca. Becca bravely determined that she could make it through Cincinnati Edition after nursing her voice for several days. So thank you for being with us. So as I mentioned, we've talked about this issue before, this program, but it's really complicated. So can you start by explaining to us what the residential tax abatement program is and what the purpose of the program is?
Yeah, so a residential tax abatement eliminates property tax on a new value added to a residential property. So we're not talking about apartment buildings or commercial properties. This is homes with between 1 and 4 units, but it's almost exclusively used for single family homes just because that's who applies. So basically, if you either build a new home on a lot or you have an existing home and you put some significant renovations into it, that adds value to the property and your property taxes would go up. But you can apply for an abatement through the city where they say, okay, you're only going to pay property taxes on the original value of the property, not on whatever new value was added. So it's not a check. It's not cash from the city to help you make renovations or anything like that. But it does save property owners money because it keeps their property taxes from going up for a certain amount of time. And there are all kinds of regulations currently and in the new program that say for how many years that tax break is in effect and how much value they will abate. So if you add, you know, $1 million home, they're not going to abate the taxes or get rid of the taxes for the entire value.
Well, thank you.
Sorry, you also asked the purpose of the program.
Sure.
The purpose of residential tax abatements, which are used throughout the country, it's at least minimally laid out. The structure is laid out in state law here in Ohio. And the purpose is to basically attract new residents. It's to incentivize renovation of property. You know, if there are vacant buildings or rundown housing, it's to incentivize property owners to fix those up so that the property values go up and it's sort of a better living environment, and also to attract new residents to the area.
Gotcha. And council's been debating changes to this program for weeks. Walk us through some of the concerns people have expressed about these changes.
Let's actually just be fair and say council's been debating these changes or changes in general for years.
Yeah,
not
true,
just weeks.
True.
But this particular ordinance, this legislation, was officially introduced in January, but it is based on a report that was commissioned by the city and released last summer. And before that, the Property Tax Working Group was looking at some of these issues. So that's where a lot of this comes from. But some of the concerns, I would say the biggest concern with this legislation has more to do with the existence of property tax abatements at all. The idea that, you know, should the city abate taxes for anyone in any part of the city? And the biggest concern there is that public schools are funded primarily, the majority of their funding comes from property tax revenue. So there's an argument that if you're saying people don't have to pay taxes on the new value they add, that takes money away from public schools. There's another side to that argument, which is that it's an incentive program. So theoretically, and I think it's true that at least some, if not many, of the projects that are getting an abatement would not have happened if not for the incentive. So the idea is we're not taking money away. We're just delaying how long, you know, the school's going to get that money. And you wouldn't have gotten it if we didn't have the incentive there. Now, are there projects that would have gone ahead without an abatement? Surely, yes. But nobody knows how many that is, how much that makes up of the program. Some of the other concerns, though, are, you know, the changes basically drastically reduce the value of an abatement in some of the wealthiest neighborhoods. And there's a group of folks who say those neighborhoods don't need any abatement. They don't need incentive. Development's going to happen there regardless. So we don't need any abatements there. And the sort of counter argument to that is the city is just now adding population for the first time in decades. And so part of that city officials attribute to tax abatements and the incentive program. And so they say, you know, we don't want to take away that incentive anywhere in the city when we're just now growing. You know, wait and see if we keep that growth strong. But in the meantime, we want people to come and live anywhere in the city. You know, we want new housing anywhere. And that's kind of the argument behind that.
Okay. So council voted 8-1 Wednesday to approve this overhaul of the program. Mm-hmm. Tell us who voted no and why.
Councilmember Liz Keating voted no. She's the only Republican on council. It's worth noting, although this isn't necessarily a partisan issue. And I think it's mostly worth noting because there were other council members who had some concerns. But as we see on many issues, the Democratic members of council, the eight of them, along with Democratic Mayor Aftab Pierville, do try to kind of stick together as a coalition, and they kind of fell into that this way as well. I'm not saying that's the only reason it passed, but just noting that sort of dynamic that we've seen a few times. Councilmember Keating, throughout this process, has said a few times, I think we should wait and do this later. Council, or more on the administrative side at this point, is working on recommended dramatic changes to zoning and land use code, basically where can multifamily housing be built. That is going through community engagement. It's going through the law department. There's more engagement coming up on that. It's a process or a reform they're calling connected communities. And Keating says, you know, we're going to be changing that anyway in the next couple of months. Let's wait on abatements and just do it all together. And, you know, the counter to that, we heard several council members say, is this conversation has been going on forever, for a long time. So although there are a few who say this was rushed, you know, didn't give time for community engagement, truthfully, I think it's more accurate to say that it's been a long time coming. And those council members will say, you know, we can't wait anymore. We've been waiting for a long time. Councilmember Jeff Kramerding, kind of said, we can't go back to voters and say we're waiting on another study. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of the thinking there. I will say that Keating kind of influenced some of the changes to this ordinance earlier on in the process, earlier this year. There were the final version that passed was the C version, so the third version. There was a B version as well. And those changes were the result of suggestions from the community that council members kind of took up, and also just some council kind of came up with on their own. And one Keating supported and spoke strongly in favor of, which was to give a higher value abatement, a bonus basically to the abatement for housing that has more than one unit, and to give even more of a bonus on top of that if the housing has more than one unit along a transit corridor, so like a 24-hour bus line. Mm. And so that's kind of where she's, again, connecting it to connected communities, because it's also related to transit corridors, another very complicated issue we'll get into later. But her saying, you know, these are really connected and overlapping issues, and that's why they should be talked about together.
So this is you. I know we could talk for a long, long time about exactly what these changes do and what this overhaul was consisted of. But tell us just a little bit how these changes changed the program.
Yeah. So previously, or really currently, because the changes don't take effect until September 1st, you could get the same abatement no matter where you are in the city. What the changes do is it splits Cincinnati's 52 neighborhoods into three categories, and the value of your abatement, how much money you can get abated, and how long that abatement lasts depends on which category your neighborhood falls into. So the top category, these are based, by the way, on things like income, poverty rate, home values. The idea being that neighborhoods that have higher income, less poverty, and a lot of market activity don't need as much of an incentive. And most neighborhoods fall into the lowest category, which is lower income, higher poverty, lower home values, and not as much construction activity. So the top tier, and these are the neighborhoods that, you know, they say don't need as much investment. They get the lowest value for the shortest amount of time. They are Columbia, Tusculum, Hyde Park, Linwood, Mount Adams, Mount Lookout, and Oakley. There are 10 neighborhoods in the middle tier, and then every other neighborhood, which is 36 neighborhoods, are in the lowest tier.
Okay.
So it is complicated, but that's kind of the nutshell.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very helpful. Well, and part of the point of these changes, as I understand it, seems to be to help address segregation in the city. Do supporters say that this will solve that problem?
Gotta ask the most complicated one. Yeah, so It is true that the current, sort of undeniably true, that the current residential tax abatement program is mostly benefiting majority white and majority wealthy communities, neighborhoods. Now, it's important to point out that tax abatements are, you know, nobody's tracking tax abatements based on race or income. It's all based on the averages of the community.
Mm-hmm. Kind of a zip code thing.
Exactly. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So, you know, the goal of the reform is to make the program more equitable, to say that neighborhoods that aren't getting as much investment, which are happen to be the neighborhoods that are majority black and majority low income, that they should get higher abatement values. But it is pretty clear, and the mayor, who kind of really championed this legislation, he has said that this is not a solve for racial segregation or economic segregation, that this will stop, help abatements from making the problem worse, and it will be a sort of incremental help, but it is not intended to be an anti-poverty program. It's not intended to be a desegregation program. It's more about making it as equitable as it can be, but knowing that lots of other factors affect racial segregation, which all officials I have talked to acknowledge is a big problem in Cincinnati, but that problem needs to be tackled in many other arenas as well.
And there's a lawsuit, right, that some black homeowners have sued the city over this program. Did the changes to this program, did that resolve the lawsuit? That didn't make...
It has not. The hope was, this lawsuit has been ongoing for a couple of years. The hope was that once the city passed reform, that the lawsuit would settle out of court and it would resolve the concerns. That is still possible. But the lawyer representing those black homeowners that sued the city said he is not happy with the changes. He believes that it might make the problem worse. He has offered a settlement agreement that is drastically different than what the city has passed. So it is still possible that a judge can say, well, I'm deciding that the reform is good enough kind of thing. But the attorney, at least representing those that lawsuit, is hoping for a different outcome.
Okay. Well, and we're running out of time to talk with you. There was one other story I wanted to talk with you about real quickly, which is another very complicated story. And that's the city's effort to sell the railway that it owns. You reported this week that state-level changes needed for the city to sell its railway could be back on track, which appreciated that pun in the headline.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. What's going on with that? I know it's very complicated, but just in a minute or so.
Okay, so city officials only want to sell the railroad if they can use the revenue, this investment account they want to create, to maintain current infrastructure. But state law that established the railroad way back when says that if the city sells the railway, they can only use the revenue to pay off debt service. So the change that's needed in state law to allow the sale to go forward was originally blocked by Republicans in the Senate a couple of weeks ago, but they reached an agreement this week that basically said, okay, fine, we'll make the changes. They added a couple, I think, relatively minor restrictions on the sale. So it will be able to go forward now. But again, it is ultimately the voters' decision. So that is likely to be on the November ballot, but it may also be on the ballot in either the spring or fall in 2024. And voters will decide whether or not the city can move ahead with that sale.
I know you'll keep covering that, too. So I've been talking with WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Thank you so much for your time today, Becca. Your voice held up really well.
Thank you, Lucy.
Up next, a BBC News crew is in town and will be broadcasting live from our studios on Monday. We'll get a preview. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. It's not often that we give you a preview of the news during our Friday news review, but that's exactly what we're going to do today. Journalists from the BBC are in Cincinnati and will broadcast live from Cincinnati Public Radio's studios on Monday. Joining me in this recorded interview to discuss what he and the BBC team will be reporting about is NewsHour presenter James Menendez. Thanks so much for being here, James.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having us.
Oh, it's a treat. So tell us a little bit first about the BBC NewsHour and your approach to reporting the news.
Well, of course, you know, your listeners will know the programme very well,
yes,
indeed,
they
I
will.
Hope. But, you know, the great privilege of doing a programme like NewsHour is you have the whole world at your fingertips. I mean, you really do. I mean, we sometimes take it for granted, I think, when we come in the morning. But you really have that great opportunity to just sit down, you know, before the programme goes out. We obviously have a sort of lead-up time, 4 or 5 hours. And just think, you know, what are the most important or most interesting things going on in the world today? And then we make a list of the stories we want to do, and we make it happen. And with what we're really lucky about, I think, is the fact that the BBC still opens so many doors. In other words, you know, we identify a story, we think, well, this is the person we want to speak to, we ring them up. And, you know, 8 times out of 10, they'll say, yeah, that would be great, we'll come on, often with very short notice. I mean, we don't, you know, a lot of the time there's preparation, but it's quite last minute because we're quite a reactive programme. We try and do as much live as possible. But, you know, people want to come on, and that's a real, real privilege.
Is there something that you think sets the BBC apart from other news outlets in terms of tone or approach or just the way you present the news?
Well, I mean, I think what we aim for is just to be fair. I mean, impartiality is the watchword now, but it always has been the watchword. And we try and be fair with everybody that we speak to, and we try and do stories in the most fair way possible. And hopefully that encourages people to then take part because they know they're going to get fair treatment at the hands of people like me, and that we're going to deal with, you know, often tricky subjects in a sensitive and also a fair way. So a lot of what we do does rest on our previous reputation, but I think and that's part of the privilege, is just taking that on and trying to maintain it, especially when, you know, the news is so fought over. I mean, perhaps the truth is so fought over these days. It's something that we, you know, we're constantly bearing in mind. And it's a constant battle, and we don't always get it right, but we really do. We do try.
Yeah. So tell us why you decided to come to Cincinnati.
Well, you invited us.
Oh, God. I didn't personally, but I'm glad that we did.
No, and we're very glad too. No, I mean, as listeners will know, NewsHour is broadcast on, I think, more than 300 public radio stations around the country, which is great, and provides, you know, a huge number of listeners, which we love. And it's good to maintain relationships. And we have, I think, a good relationship with your radio station. And so we thought, what a great opportunity to come over, see Cincinnati, do a little bit of reporting, and meet some of your listeners and our listeners. Because actually, the one thing that we don't have working in London for the BBC doing international news is we have, you know, less contact with our listeners than I guess you guys have. I mean, you're very much part of the community, and it's a smaller community. So you're much more in touch with what your listeners are interested in. And it's sometimes difficult for us to feel that contact. So actually being able to come over, meet some people who listen to the program and are interested in the program, that's great too.
How have you been received by those people?
Well, by you guys, very well. And everyone's been super friendly in the city. We've had a very warm welcome from everybody. And in fact, when we, you know, people obviously hear our accents and say, you know, where are you from? And then we explain that we're from the BBC. People are very excited, which is really, I mean, it's so nice. It's really nice.
That's good. You never just try to say Cleveland.
Is that an Ohio joke?
So without giving away too much, explain a bit what you'll be reporting on Monday. I understand you've been learning a bit about the culture wars in the U.S.
Yeah, well, we've just come back from Kentucky. We went down to Frankfort. I mean, this is a good example of a complex, sensitive story, but it's certainly one that's been replicated, I mean, all over the US, but also in Europe as well. And it's really, it's culture wars, and in this case, related to some legislation that some of it's gone through and some of it is still going through the state government there, and related in particular to transgender rights as they relate to teenagers, counselling, and what they call gender affirmation as well in schools. But also the aspect that we wanted to focus on was this proposal essentially to ban drag acts, not completely, but from public spaces and anywhere where children might be able to watch. And it felt to us like a good illustration of, stories that are certainly a hot topic in the UK. But we went down there yesterday, and I mean, amazing. There were, you know, hundreds of people outside the state capitol protesting and inside, which I was quite surprised, actually, because our sort of public buildings where government takes place, protesters aren't allowed in. But actually, they were allowed in, and I think generally quite well behaved. But there was a real sense of suddenly a debate going on and democracy in action, even though obviously very, very strong feelings on both sides.
Yeah. Did you find the discussion that you encountered very different from the discussion you're hearing in London or in other places in Europe?
I think it's surprisingly similar, actually. Surprisingly similar. I mean, again, it's one of those subjects that does drive extremes on both sides, although I suspect that there is probably more consensus on these matters than one sometimes thinks. And there's certainly nuance, but I mean, but powerful arguments, you know, on both sides, from those who feel that their minority LGBTQ rights have been eroded to those conservatives who feel that their, in quotes, family values are being eroded. And people were very, very polite and considerate to us. But, I mean, there's passion on both sides, a lot of passion.
Did you have luck talking to the lawmakers who sponsored any of these measures?
We did, on both sides. And actually, yeah. Well, as you'll hear, some very, very powerful interviews from a Republican senator and a Democrat senator. Very powerful interviews. I don't want to get too much away, but well,
sure.
Worth it. I mean, it was real sort of stop what you're doing radio, actually.
Yeah.
Really powerful, yeah.
That's
yeah.
That BBC reputation, I guess, at play, because some of those senators have not been talking to other media very
right,
much.
Right, okay. Well, yeah. That's interesting to know. Yeah.
So I understand one of Cincinnati's strengths is its drinking water, and I understand you've been kind of looking into that too.
We are going to.
We are going
to be looking at that. I mean, water, it was a story actually that came up for us in London about a week or 10 days ago, a big UN report into the quality of water and how many billions of people don't have access to good drinking water. And I know, of course, it's being a big issue here in the US with a series of pollution incidents, of course, East Palestine, and so on. And so with Cincinnati's reputation for leading the way in terms of cleaning water, we thought that was a good starting point to explore that issue of, you know, why can't what Cincinnati is doing be replicated elsewhere? Why is it that in such a rich country, one of the richest countries in the world, people are still worried about the quality of their drinking water when it is an issue for much of our audience around the world? I think they'd be fascinated to hear that America, you know, people are still worried about contaminants in their water, either long-term or short-term. So that's an issue we're going to be exploring in the next day or so.
Okay, we've got some time. We're pre-recording this, so by the time this airs, I'm sure you'll be well into that reporting.
Well, I hope so.
Yeah. So what's the number one thing you think you've learned? Is there some big difference while reporting in Cincinnati that really strikes you?
I'll tell you, I know exactly what the answer to that is, and it is simply that people are just unbelievably articulate and willing to talk. I don't want to denigrate, you know, my fellow country men and women, but people are more reticent, I think. But honestly, you just switch on the microphone and people have a lot to say, and they say it in an incredibly kind of persuasive and engaging way. So it's been an absolute joy to be reporting here.
Oh, well, good. Maybe you'll come back.
I hope so, if you'll have me.
Well, thank you. I've been talking with BBC NewsHour presenter James Menendez. Thanks so much for your time, James.
Thank you very much. Look forward to Monday.
Yeah, we look forward to hearing your report on Monday. Up next, we're going to talk about some important education news from the past week. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. A small note about the interview you just heard with James Menendez. Because of the breaking news with former President Trump that happened yesterday, their plans on Monday might be changing a little bit. So keep that in mind when you listen to the BBC's live broadcast from our studios on Monday. Faculty unions across Ohio are uniting against Senate Bill 83, a measure that would ban diversity, equity, and inclusion training for university students and faculty, among other provisions. Joining me to discuss that legislation and some of his other reporting from the past week is WVXU reporter Zach Carrion. Welcome back, Zach.
Hi. Happy Friday, Lucy.
Happy Friday to you. It's been a long week, hasn't it?
Yes, it has.
So I mentioned you reported this week on Senate Bill 83 and how faculty and staff at universities are opposing it. First, tell us a little bit more about this legislation and what it would do.
Yeah, so this was a bill introduced by State Senator Jerry Serino. He's from, you know, the northern part of the state, Lake County area. And what this is it's kind of designed to cut bias from the classroom in college, in higher education. That's the intent of the bill. Serino describes it as what's happening right now with higher education is he sees a lot of what's called social engineering, basically bias and trying to, I guess, teach students what to think. I think that's the intention behind this bill. That's what he's going for. There's a lot of things in this bill that some professors and some institutions are against here.
Yeah, well, you've done a good job of explaining what the sponsor's intentions are and what his concerns are and why he introduced this. So tell us what the opponents of the bill have to say.
Well, the main thing here is the people that I've spoken to about this call this everything in one bill. It encompasses a lot of things. Some of the things that it does encompass is certain bans on certain types of subjects and things. So it would mean a ban on requiring diversity, equity, and inclusion training. Serino says that, you know, this is kind of a bloated part of university budgets where you have these departments dedicated to this type of training, and he doesn't necessarily see a purpose for that. Now, a lot of people would definitely disagree with that, but from his perspective, he does not see any value to diversity training. It would also ban, and this is pretty important, strikes for employees. That includes faculty. Obviously, that one raises a lot of concerns with faculty union leaders. It's a big way of how they negotiate, and a lot of times it's seen as like a last resort when it comes to contract negotiations with faculty. So that's a big part of this. And then obviously the bias in the classroom, which doesn't necessarily have an exact definition, which worries some people. And it would also forbid programs from partnering with the People's Republic of China, which is also an interesting part. So a lot of things this bill bans, but it would also require some other things, which is every student would have to take an American history course. And the syllabuses for all those courses would have to be posted online. So every professor, a couple weeks into each semester would have to post their syllabus to be viewed publicly online. That's also a part of this. And professors would be evaluated to see if they show bias. Again, this is not, anything that's kind of, a design system or anything. This could be anything from student evaluations that can, flag them as biased. So there's a lot of things in this bill, as you can tell. And a lot of it is very concerning to a lot of educators.
Yeah. Well, you interviewed the chair of the University of Cincinnati's Association of University Professors. What did he have to say about this?
He says this is really a culture war issue. So like when I was talking about social engineering earlier, those kind of terms have been used in, K through 12 education. We've seen this conversation before when it comes to critical race theory and what kids are reading along those lines. This is kind of in the same the same family as that, right? It's all about what students are learning in the classroom and how, from some people's perspective, it can be seen as, manipulating or trying to teach people to think a certain way. Steve Maccabee, the president of the association there, he sees this as a violation of academic freedom. For a lot of people, higher education universities are when you're introduced to certain subjects, certain topics that you didn't learn earlier on in life. And maybe certain things you might be exposed to certain cultures, certain parts of history that you aren't familiar with, things outside of what you know. That's kind of a fundamental part of higher education. So he sees that as a big threat, a big threat to what higher education is all about. And, ultimately, if something like this goes through, that is going to turn off a lot of students, a lot of faculty to being a part of universities. This is a bill that would affect, major public institutions in Ohio. And, if you're rejecting certain topics and requiring certain things, that is going to rub people the wrong way, and people might not be wanting to come to Ohio institutions from elsewhere, and students here maybe looking elsewhere if these are part of the things that they have to learn.
Mm. I believe Steve Maccabee also talked with you about that history course you referenced. What did he think the problem was with that required history course?
Yeah, it's, you know, in an American-based history course. So there are required readings, which would include, you know, the Declaration of Independence, the Federalist Papers, Martin Luther King's letter from Birmingham Jail. So there's, you know, some required readings in there. And you know, those aren't bad things to read, right? But, you know, a lot of students are already familiar with those things. They're major parts of American history. And his main objection is, you know, requiring educators to teach this stuff. They want to have control over their classroom. They want to have control over what they're teaching students. It's part of why a lot of educators became professors. They wanted that freedom, and they think it's a really important part of higher education.
Yeah. What are faculty unions doing in reaction to this bill?
Well, they're making their voices heard. Last week, they came out to the State House for the first hearing of this bill. They filled the room, and this was, you know, faculty members from unions all over the state. So, you know, Ohio State, Wright State, University of Cincinnati, and pretty much every major university you can think of. Professors were there sharing their displeasure with this bill. And from what I hear, they plan to continue doing so and just doing everything they can to stop this bill because they do see it as critical to higher education in Ohio. It could really affect how higher education operates in the state for years to come.
Well, we're running short on time. I have another complicated report to ask you about. You covered a news conference this week related to Governor Mike DeWine's proposed funding to hire more school resource officers. How has the governor explained his reasoning behind this? This is hundreds of millions of dollars we're talking about, right?
Yeah. So this is a part of the governor's budget plan for the year that is yet to be approved. but it would include $338 million in funding to hire school resource officers. The reason why he did this is, you know, we all know it, right? There's been school shootings across the country. There was, of course, that one recently in Nashville. So there's definitely a desire to have school resource officers in our schools. But other organizations...
Becca jinxed you.
Sorry.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So, but, you know, ACLU and some other organizations pointed out that there may be some issues with this. The ACLU pointed to a study here in Cincinnati where more students of color, black students, were being detained and arrested by these school resource officers at a higher rate than white students. It was five times more than white students, so pretty significant, and that number is more than the national average. So they want to see more counselors. They want to see more mental health professionals. So basically they wanted more flexibility in this funding for that instead of a resource officer.
Yeah. Well, and you've got a lot more detail in your story on our website, WVXU.org. We'll give your voice a break, and I will suggest everybody check that out online. I've been talking with WVXU reporter Zach Carrion. Thanks so much for your time today, Zach.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Derek Smith. If you miss our program live, you can subscribe to Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening, and I hope you all have a great weekend.